Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and also Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I'm so excited on the Celebrity Show first to welcome my co-host, writer, talk show host extraordinaire, Blake Robinson. Blake, how are you, man?
Terrific, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here. And really looking forward to speaking with Quentin Aaron.
Oh, yeah. And there goes the spoil alert, Blake. But yes, I am so excited to welcome the program. And when I think about a story like this, I love backstories. I love hearing about people that are truly making a difference with children and also had a very difficult time and challenges to make it and be a successful actor and everything. So I want to welcome the program. He played Michael Orr from The Blind Side. It was an Oscar-nominated film. Everyone remembers him playing Michael Orr, The Blind Side, with Sandra Bullock. So I want to welcome the program, celebrity Quentin Aaron. Quentin, how are you, man? And I'm excited to have the chance to talk to you today.
I'm awesome. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fantastic. And I think that the first thing that you could say to yourself is you never thought you'd be in this position right now, speaking about your foundation and all the tremendous things you're doing in your life right now compared to where you were before you got this role in The Blind Side. Isn't that correct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This has definitely been a blessing the past few years. And, I mean, yeah, if you asked me back then, and I myself doing that, I probably would have said no, but I feel like my mom would have said yeah, because she was the type of person that always, you know, thought positive and always, you know, believed in, you know, saying that you already achieved what you want in life. That way you spoke it into existence. You know.
Exactly, and you're definitely a humbling person for sure, Blake. And I don't know if you know about the backside story, Blake, but he pretty much was rock bottom, struggling to make it, and he got this opportunity with The Blind Side. So he really didn't have a lot of acting experience, Blake.
I read that while you were auditioning for The Blind Side, you made a short list of potential actors for the main role, and because you thought you were a long shot, you approached the director about working security for the film, which was another source of income that you had at the time. Was that something that, how did that come about?
Well, when I went into the meeting with the director, I brought some of my stars with me because I was doing freelance theory at the time, and I was also working on TV sets and movie sets doing security. So I was like, you know, growing up, I was never really used to great things happening. And, you know, while it was cool that I flew out to the Cali to meet the director, I still felt like it was a 1 in a million opportunity, you know, for me to get this movie. I was like, not that lucky. You know, so I really didn't see myself getting that part. So I was like, I was still with it, you know, either way. I was, you know, it's my way of networking. You know, I could be on the set, meet people, and possibly get up the connections. I was still as a worker. Possibly one day somebody will hire me in their film. So I get on business cards and, you know, told them I'll come on set and do security if need be. And, you know, I'll protect whoever he wants to. You know, it was that. That was
necessary. And it's amazing, Quentin, because of where you were. And I want you to describe that place you were at before this opportunity happened. Because in a lot of ways, you probably thought that just because of what was going on in your life and what things weren't ultimately going your way at that time. You were working security, but you were struggling. And tell us a little about how much you were struggling before you got this opportunity.
Well, the months leading up to the call was, they were some of the hardest months of my life. I had recently lost my mom 4 months before. She passed away in September of 08. And once she passed, you know, her Social Security like cut off. So I no longer had the income to pay the rent. And me and my brother was living under the same roof at the time. The little bit of money I made from security was only, you know, barely able to still feed us. But then jobs dried up, so it was no, you know, there was no work for a while. With the check stopping, unfortunately, couldn't pay other people, so we lost the lights, lost water, and I would have to walk like 3 miles every day to get food from my aunt to bring that stove for me and my brother to eat. This was during the winter. And so, yeah, we were living for like 4 months in the house with no lights and water. We would go to my aunt's house to shower and,
oh, wow,
and then go back home. But at dark to go to sleep. And then, you know, so it was, that was how we were living for a while. And then I was constantly going back and forth to court to try and prolong our stay in the apartment as long as possible because we hadn't paid the rent for months. So we were trying to be forced out. Well, I mean, we were being forced out by the shame. And, you know, so there's that whole battle. And then one day I finally got a job doing security for a commercial at Philips Studios. And on the last day of that commercial shoot, I got a call from my manager out of the blue. And when I answered the phone, like, not even thinking, she said, "Quentin, guess what?" And I said, "The Blind Side." And this had been 1 year and 3 months since I heard anything from anybody with that movie.
Oh, wow.
Because the movie got put on hold for a while. And there was like the whole work strike thing. And I guess there was some whole thing between Fox Searchlight and Warner Brothers, you know, some back and forth there. So I hadn't heard anything over a year. But when she called and said, "And guess what? The Blind Side popped out of my mouth." And she said, "How did you know?" And I was in so much, I dropped the phone. And I think I almost broke my phone. I was like, "Oh, shit." And picked it up. And she was like, "Yes, they're going to do the movie. They're still going to do the movie. They want to know if you still want to play the leak." And I'm like, "Yes. You didn't have to ask me that." You know, and so that was just it. That was where I was at before the call. When the call came, everything changed.
Wow. Blake, isn't that an amazing story? Because it kind of really, it seems like Michael's story in a lot of ways. It's just a little different.
I was thinking the same thing. I was going to ask whether your experience, basically at rock bottom, no money to pay for food, no money to pay for electricity, gave you insight into playing this role of Michael Orr, which, where he came from a similar place.
Yeah, definitely. And the struggles, even though it was different situations, the struggles were the same, and to some extent. So it was just somewhat easy for me to channel my emotions through what I went through and to relate it to the character of Michael Orr and kind of get that, you know, that feel what they're looking for. And that's what the director wanted me to do because I hadn't met Michael prior to filming. I only met Michael for the first time really last year in Chicago. We did an autograph signing back in April.
So you basically had to look at the story, basically, Quentin, and say to yourself, okay, based on the script and not really know who the person Michael Orr was. You just learned it through the story. And a lot of the things you guys both were at rock bottom, really had low self-esteem at a certain point. You even mentioned this. Your mom knew you'd make it, Quentin, but You didn't think you'd make it. You definitely didn't think you'd be talking about a foundation now. But looking at Michael Orr's background and what Michael went through, where basically he didn't even want to think about playing football. He was quiet. He really was just happy just to have a meal and have people who loved him. And pretty much the same type of thing. So you could really think about, especially when tears came, you were going through some of those hard times with tears, especially leading up to the film, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was everything before the film was, you know, it was terrible. And a lot of times I feel like the only thing that kept me going was the fact that I had a young brother to look after.
Yes.
Yeah. So he was really my main reason. I'll tell you the truth, I probably would have been in jail if I didn't have a younger brother to look after. Because it was like a big situation with the landlord of my building, the name of my past, and it really had me feeling, you know, some type of way, and I was looking for him. You know, I was looking for him, and, you know, I find him. But
yes.
It was... That's the story for another time.
Absolutely. And it's especially what you can talk to youth about and different things like that, Blake. And what we're learning from Quentin is the story, the backstory before the film and all, then the life changes, Blake. And what I like about listening to Quentin talking to him is how his humility, Blake, you could just hear. He just is still very grounded in many things, Blake. He really sees truly what he's trying to do for people.
I appreciate the same thing. It seems that even after a breakout hit and Blindside, you managed to level head about how things about your own success and how things have progressed. I would imagine that your experience going through a really terrible situation helped you realize that success comes and goes, but what really matters is who you are, your values, and things like that. So that probably helps to reduce the sort of problems that can come with quick fame, I would imagine.
Yeah, it does. It does. You know, it's like the last year, if you spent 24 years of your life being raised as some person, a little bit of notoriety, fame, and money shouldn't be able to change that overnight. It's a completely different person. You know, I believe in what I was told growing up. I believe in the values I was taught. And I like the person that I am. So the way I see it is that, you know, if I do make any changes to my character, it'll be to adapt to my environment, but it won't completely change me from being the person that I am growing up. I don't believe in big egos or, you know, I don't believe in being an a-hole, you know, just because, you know, my status may have gone from 0 to 60 or 0 to 100 or whatever. You know, I don't abuse my authority. You know, I still recognize that there's so many people into positions where I used to be.
Yes.
That may have dreams to be where I am. And for that reason alone, I feel like showing them, you know, how I did what I did and why I stayed grounded and, you know, what I went through and that they can get out of it. You know.
Yes.
If we don't use those platforms that are given to us for those reasons, then I feel it's selfish of us because no one will ever have any kind of roadmap on how to make it, you know, to their dream or to their career or to be what they want to be.
Absolutely. And I think, Quentin, from that, that's why you started your foundation. You look at specifically, and we'll talk about the story of why you created the Quentin, started the Quentin Aaron Foundation. But I think that what you are always looking to do is to pay it forward for what happened to you. You want to be able to help others get the opportunity. But why, I guess, the whole mission of the Quentin Aaron Foundation, where did that come from?
Well, a couple of years ago, I met David Tyler, who's the executive director of my foundation. And I was in Tampa at the time doing an event, and I was speaking to other children at the school. And David had approached me before I left and asked me if I ever thought of starting my foundation. And at the moment he said that, I was like, no, I haven't, but that would be cool, you know, to have my own. Because literally since the movie came out, I moved to California. I was just doing majority charity most of the time, like 80% of the time. I've been speaking on behalf of certain foundations. I've been going to school, speaking to kids. I've been spoken at a doctor's conference in Chicago one time. Huh. I forgot how that came about. But, you know, and so when he asked me that, his follow-up question was, if you did start a foundation, what would it be about? And the main thing that popped in my head was bullying.
Oh, great.
And obesity. And it was mainly because growing up, those were the two things I dealt with. I was bullied a lot. I was chased home. I was beat up. I even got beat up by a girl one time. Not fun when it happened. You know, it was never fun getting beat up by anybody, let alone a girl in front of the whole entire class. But you know, looking back now, I can laugh at those things. And you know, I had a mom who was amazing at, you know, telling me the right things and raising me the right way. So I knew how to deal with certain situations, but I realized that in today's society, there's so many people, there's so many kids who don't know how to deal with those things.
Yes.
Who you know, their feelings are, you know, everything. And because of it, it's a lot of kids that are taking their own lives on the account of how they're being treated and the lack of love they're feeling. And I just wanted to do something about, you know, changing those, you know, frowns upside down, you know, because of what I've heard.
Bullying speaks, as an educator, Quentin, bullying speaks to me so much, especially I have 5 kids of my own, Quentin, and my oldest has gone through being bullied at her school, and this is a Catholic school, and it's a very, very hurtful thing for a parent to deal with this pain, Blake, and to deal with this on a daily basis and tell them it's going to be okay. And it's a process, and we need to figure out ways, Blake, to eliminate bullying in schools, and Michael's and Quentin's trying to do that in so many ways.
I can imagine how difficult that can be as a parent and as a person being bullied. It really is amazing to me that bullying has grown so much. It seems, at least in the news lately, it really seems to be an issue. Is it something that's prevalent in all schools, or are some schools pretty immune from this sort of thing? Is it more prevalent in, let's say, you know, tougher neighborhoods, or does it also happen in more well-to-do neighborhoods?
What is
I feel like it happens everywhere.
Yes, it does.
You know, it's everywhere I've gone, I've met someone that can relate to bullying in some sense. It becomes such an epidemic, and it's only evolved over the years, because when I was in school, there was no such thing as cyberbullying. It was all in your face. And now, it was all social media and how it advanced. There's, you know, cyberbullying. There's Instagram and Twitter battles.
Yes,
there's,
it's terrible.
Posting stuff on Facebook about people that now, not only the kids at school can see it and laugh about it, but when you go back home, your friends around the neighborhood also see what people are saying about you. Or, you know, it's like it's a wider audience of people that can see what's being said about you that you may find as the most embarrassing thing in the world.
Yes.
And that has got to stop. And I think the message that I try to give when I speak to these schools and places, like, first of all, we'll do like 2 events most of the time. One during the school day where we speak to the kids, and then another one in the evening so that the parents can come back. Because you know how I say that you take the village to raise a kid?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I feel like it also takes a village to help stop this issue, because you can't depend on kids to stop themselves. They have to be forced to stop.
Yes.
You know, it's like when you're raising them and you're inflicting that obedience, you know, you're trying to get them to do good, you have to also be involved in their everyday, day-to-day lives. You can't just go hurt. Come home and say, "How's your day?" And expect them to tell the truth, because they're not.
They're not going to tell you the truth, Quentin. And that's just such a hard thing to deal with. And you're doing tremendous things there. Now, give us an update on especially the golf tournament coming up, the celebrity golf tournament, and some of the people that are going to be at your golf tournament. And I can't believe you're probably saying, "Wow, a celebrity golf tournament that I'm running and to help stop this some of those issues and stuff." So, tell us specifically what's happening there.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I understand it's like a charity golf tournament. What does golf have to do with bullying? Honestly, right off the gate, I would say the tournament is a way of me reaching out to people from different fields that, you know, can help us get this foundation on the ground. Like, for the most part, a lot of people that start foundations are rich, and they have money already backing it.
Right.
I'm nowhere near rich. I'm an actor who's still trying to make this, you know, footing in Hollywood, but I'm also at the same time trying to use my free time to do good things. And while I don't have all the money in the world yet, I believe that there's people in all walks of life that support this cause. And the reason why I decided to put on a golf tournament is because over the past 4 years, I've played in about a dozen. My game still isn't all that good, but I find the game interesting, and I see how many people like it. And, you know, I've, you know, grown accustomed to hanging out with golfers and riding around on the carts and having fun and just seeing what good things come from getting a bunch of people together, like the swing sticks and right checks. So we're trying to really, you know, pull that together and hopefully help get this foundation off the ground so that we can raise the funds to travel to these schools, you know, to get what we need as far as transportation and stay to go and take the kids and put on events and, you know, create programs for these kids and then speak to parents and put together packages that we can get to help them with trying to end it. And, you know, I'm a very hands-on guy. So instead of, like, you know, staying in one place and creating a commercial and just putting that out there and hoping that that does the job, I'm that guy that's going to travel to different cities, come sit down with you in your living room and talk it out. I'm the guy that's going to come to your school and visit you one-on-one or stand up close and personal and talk with you.
That's great.
Trying to get this, because I want people to know that I care and I'm not just doing this one person.
That's so awesome. That's most definitely, Quentin. So what celebrities are going to be at your golf tournament? I saw the list. I thought Dikembe Mutombo is going to be there. Who else?
We have Dan Glover, Charles Barkley, I invited a couple of my friends, the Massey brothers, Cal and Chris Mack, Disney Kids. They are, everyone knows Cal from That's So Raven. He was Raven's little brother. Raven's little brother, sorry. And Corrine House, you guys doing our Disney Channel forever. Me and Cal did a movie last year, which hasn't released yet. You know, just been real cool ever since. We are also a part of another foundation, which I've invited some people from the profile. We have Clay Aiken.
Wow.
Former American Idol runner-up. Yeah, he's going to be there. I'm excited to meet him. I invited a lot of my friends. Hopefully, some of them will show up. If they're not, you know, too busy. You know, I understand a lot of people now on a lot of different projects, but
You have an awesome tournament, Quentin. Come on. The people you've just named, you have an awesome golf tournament, to say the least, for sure. When is this taking place? And
it's actually taking place on my 30th birthday, August 15th, in Atlanta, Georgia.
Awesome.
So it's a week close to huge day for me, weekend for me. I'll be leaving my 20s, the party from my 20s into the 30s, which, according to Dave Z, 30 is the new 20, so I guess I'll still be starting over the 20s again.
You're in great shape for sure, Quentin. And so where can we find information on your celebrity golf tournament and also some of your latest projects? Where can we go?
Oh, man, you can find information on the tournament on my website, www.quentinaron.org. And just for information on me and what I'm up to lately, I am all over social media, like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. My Twitter is just at Quentin Aron. You can also find me on Instagram at the same name, and my Instagram will come up, and my Facebook as well. I am currently casting a movie that I'm going to be starring in Wisconsin, the end of September, called Halfway.
All right.
It was a little bit that he would a great, you know, see me trying to farm a farmer. I'm an ex-con who lives on my probation on a farm in an all-white town where I'm the only black guy. And it's going to be interesting, me trying to, you know, learn how to milk cows and running from animals and a lot of different stuff. So it's going to be some comedy to it, but part to it, the drama. And so it's one of those good, you know, indie stories that when you see it, you're like, well, I'm glad I'm
Giving
away too much.
Fantastic, Quentin. You're impressed, Blake, aren't you, by Quentin and how well he's doing and how he's really trying to help others. What a great job isn't he doing, Blake?
That is a wonderful thing to see, that with the extra time which you have, which I'm sure is minimal given your heavy schedule and the upcoming movies, that you use it to work on these issues which really plagued you during your youth and which are huge these days, obesity and bullying. It's something that I wish more people would spend their extra time working on, something that is close to their heart, and I'm sure it really is rewarding on your end as well.
Thanks again for being on the program, Quentin. We'll stay in touch, and best of luck, and everyone needs to go to your website to check out everything, and thanks again for calling, man.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, take care, Quentin. See you later. Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Radio Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. And definitely Pinterest, Neil Haley. And I'm really excited always to have NFL players, especially former NFL athletes, who have been able to take life after football and have such great success and also give it back to the community. So I'm so excited to welcome the program, Carl Lester Klumpler. And Carl Lester is a former Viking and Seattle Seahawk. Carl Lester, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you. And really, the Crumpler family is an interesting family background just in football in general. I guess you pretty much loved football growing up, right? Sounds like.
Well, yeah, I was actually born while my dad was in college playing college football at East Carolina University. And so I grew up around the game. My dad ended up becoming a sportscaster with the local CBS affiliate. So really was around football pretty much all of my life, and had an opportunity to play in junior high school and carry that over into high school, college, and eventually the pros.
And also, your brother's Algie Crumpler, and he had a successful NFL career as well. Did your father play in the NFL?
My dad was actually drafted by the Buffalo Bills, but the year that he was drafted, I want to say 1974, 1975, if I'm not mistaken, was a strike year, and O.J. Simpson just so happened to be the starting tailback there. So he ended up getting traded that offseason to the Redskins, and then some things just didn't pan out the way that he had hoped, and ended up playing a year in Canada.
Okay, all right. So pretty much professional athletes in general. And were you and Algie close in age to, like, compete against each other during, I guess, to have that competitive phase?
No, I'm the big brother, and you know, he's about 6 years younger than I am, and he's the middle of two brothers. So he has another brother, Brian, is our youngest, and he's next in age to Algie. There's about a 2-year age difference between Algie and Brian. So they really more or less grew up together more so than me and Algie.
Did Algie want to look up to Big Brother and how he was really good in football and saying, I want to do the same?
Well, absolutely. I think if you talked with him, he would tell you how he used to sell concessions concessions at East Carolina football games, and when the offense would be out there, he would basically stop selling, sit down, and watch me play. So didn't realize I was as much of an inspiration for him whenever he was coming up through middle school and junior high school. But eventually he went off to had a great high school career, college career at UNC Chapel Hill, and then played 10 years in the National Football League.
Absolutely. So you got, again, two NFL players in Algie and yourself. And when you were you surprised, especially were you prepared for life after football, especially playing 5 years, and I don't know if you thought your career was going to be any longer and have to go and change your mindset in so many ways?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that when my career ended, there was a lot going on in the country that I think impacted us all. I finished my career in Minnesota, ended up having a knee injury that had where I ended up getting surgery, but never really recovered to perform at the expected level in training camp, which was going to be my second year in Minnesota, but ended up leaving Minnesota and relocated to Seattle in the late fall of 2000. And if you can think back to what was going on in this country 14 years ago, was the beginning of the technology bubble bursting, and we entered into a recession. So, I mean, it was a lot going on around our country. Can't say my stock portfolio weathered that storm well. So ended up losing a lot of money, ended up having some challenges relationally with a marriage that I was in at the time. And so and then ended up needing more knee surgeries. Ended up having four more knee surgeries over the next couple of years as I was in the process of looking to reinvent myself and enter into corporate America.
So entering into corporate America, so that's, again, like you said, the money that you made in the NFL, certain investments, certain things. Now I got to go out there and work. And to jump into corporate America, did you think college prepared you for corporate America, or you think the NFL prepared you for corporate America?
You know, corporate America is different, just as football or pro sports are different from corporate America. I think the aggregate of all of my life experience as well as sports experiences helped prepare me somewhat for corporate America. I think there's a lot of intangibles that I was able to bring to the corporate workplace that really fit well, given how we have to respond to challenges and adversity and given how competitive things can be in the marketplace. But you know me being just like anybody else who comes out of college or enters into you know, a new job, I mean, you've got to learn how things work. The way the company wants things done could be different than what you're accustomed to, so you really need to be flexible and be willing to adapt, but also have just a real positive attitude as you go throughout all the different changes.
The positive attitude is so important. And from where did you start right when you started your career out of football? What did you do?
Well, you know, I ironically stepped into the beginnings of a career that was just the worst time to be trying to raise startup capital for raise capital for startup companies in the middle of a technology bubble bursting. But I ended up, you know, really finding myself finding ways to be creative and persistent. I ended up doing corporate sales for a global health and fitness organization. So I just really kind of dibbled and dabbled in a number of different things, but really realized that, you know, I really need to take a step back and really get more clarity around what I may want to do in this next phase of my life. So eventually I made my way back to Eastern North Carolina, back to my alma mater, East Carolina University, and really sought to finish up getting my MBA.
That was key, wasn't it, Carl Lester? That you needed to get that MBA to really set a full foothold in the area. Being a former NFL athlete, that helps a lot in you know, getting in the foot in the door sometimes or opportunity, but you got to have that training to be successful like you are today in business.
Yeah, I think it is important. I think when I did seek my MBA, it was around that time period where, you know, you did have a lot of people that ended up unemployed due to the technology bubble bursting in the recession, and people were trying to find ways to really become more marketable in the marketplace. You know, none of that was my rationale for going back and getting my MBA. I was actually at East Carolina University for 5 years. My first year I had 3 shoulder surgeries, so I ended up redshirting that year, but ended up getting my degree in 4 years. So my 5th year, I decided that I would take a couple of courses in the MBA program, and so I did that. But then, you know, ended up being about an 8 or 9 year gap from the time that I left to East Carolina University to the time that I came back. So I was really wanting to finish something that I had started.
Definitely. Finishing something that you started, showing again how education is a very important thing, telling young athletes out there, and I'm sure you have this conversation with them a lot of times, saying, you know what, you always got to have that backup. Because you don't never know when that NFL career is going to end. You never know who you could trust with your money at times, and that you always have to have another backup to go forward. And at least you did see education as an important thing in East Carolina, even though you might have thought you're going to play in the NFL, and you made the right choices for sure to go back for your degree.
Yeah, well, you know, I think almost every good athlete thinks that they're going to go pro. Okay. In their sport, but you know, I think on one hand, the kids don't realize how short-lived their careers could be. Some may end up being able to play 10, 12, 14 years, but the average career in the NFL is only 3 years. And so if you're, you know, 3 years removed from college, then you're more than likely 24, 25 years old. I mean, you've got a whole lot of life left ahead of you, and you really need to do something with your life versus just sit around or going to play golf or just kind of hanging out in a fitness club, you know, lifting weights and partying all night.
Because at one point in time, that bubble burst, and it did for you financially at times, and you made the right decisions, and you saw how important education was. So you received your MBA at East Carolina University. Then where did you go on from there in your corporate career?
Well, you know, eventually, once I finished grad school, it led me to Bank of America, where I'm actually second generation crumpler at Bank of America. So I was fortunate to follow in my father's footsteps playing football, and now I'm following in my mother's footsteps being a banker. So for the last nine and a half years, I've worked in a couple of different areas within Bank of America. Currently, I spearhead the nonprofit banking effort for Bank of America in the state of Georgia, and work with a lot of really large nonprofits that have a profound impact on the local community, the state, the region, the country, and some even globally.
So that's really impressive in ways. What made you choose that area, being in the nonprofit area at Bank of America, to help with working with nonprofits?
Well, I didn't necessarily choose it. I think it more or less chose me. Okay. I wasn't aware of the fact that the bank had a not-for-profit banking group. I do like to say, when I do meet with people, although we are not-for-profit, we're not for loss either. Because this is how, you know, I provide for my family. But the work that we do in partnership with our clients is really geared toward helping them achieve greater mission impact in the communities they serve. So in a lot of ways, the work that we do directly as well as indirectly has a profound and positive impact on the community. So that there is a lot of feel good to the work that we do, especially when we know that we're bringing ideal solutions and services to our clients that help them continue to further their mission.
Do you reach out in your area to nonprofits, especially that are some of the foundations of former NFL athletes or current NFL athletes with Bank of America, or is it more just local area for you, for who you cover and work with?
Well, it tends to be a lot larger, more well-established nonprofits, and not necessarily the nonprofit that maybe a local athlete or celebrity has started up here in the community.
So you're working with more of the bigger ones. That really, a lot of non-for-profits, if you talk about one in my area, UPMC is a non-profit hospital that's, it's worth billions. So there's definite people out there, that these organizations that are gigantic, that have so many people, so many employees, so many people to run, that they need someone like yourself to keep in the competitive urge of, we got to not lose money. We got to make money, and we got to help the community as well, right?
Exactly. And the difference between not-for-profit versus for-profit is, a not-for-profit, they essentially take what for-profits call profit. In the not-for-profit world, we call it surplus, but you take the surplus and pour it back into the community. With a for-profit, you're taking the profits and sharing them with the shareholders. So there's a difference there. But in some communities, and you just alluded to UPMC, I mean, they're probably a really large job creator or employer within the Pittsburgh region and the surrounding areas. So we do work with not-for-profit hospitals and health systems. We do work with private colleges and universities. We also work with large religious organizations, and then also an array of social service, cultural, and membership nonprofits.
Well, congratulations for the success at Bank of America, Carl Lester. It must be really great to, again, have the success that you had on the football field to be able to take it to the corporate world. So really, congratulations for that.
I appreciate that.
All right. So do you have anything else going on, any other projects yourself, working with people, or anything else that you would like to share with our audience that you're promoting right now?
I think, one of the big things, the big initiatives that I'm engaged with here in the Metro Atlanta community centers around mentoring men in particular. So I am a radical mentor, as they call it, through the radical mentoring group. And, I've taken it upon myself to engage with a group of married men here in the Metro Atlanta area and really, seek to share with the guys the things that I've been able to learn around different topics and areas. And then, men are unique in that we have, different issues and challenges and things that really we would really need to focus on, be it focusing on how we can be better fathers or parents, how we can be better husbands.
Tremendous, yes.
Getting our priorities in order such that you don't find yourself cheating your family for the sake of trying to become more established at work, or not cheat your work and bring your best to the workplace because you're so focused on everything that's going on at home. But you know, I think it's just a really unique initiative that's in place. And you know, what really got me thinking about the role that I could play with men in the community just centered around the fact that when I first moved to Atlanta back in 2005, one of the first articles I read shared that only one in four black males graduates high school in Atlanta public schools.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's
and,
big, yeah.
You know, there were three things that came to mind. One, you said that creates a huge leadership gap within the black community. It has a negative impact on the socioeconomic construct within, or so the socioeconomic situation within the black community, and it has a negative impact on the construct of family within the black community. And you know, really, any one of those three independently could devastate a community, but all three really, you know, will obliterate a community and a generation or generations of people. But you know, I think there's a lot of really good social programs in place in this country that are geared toward engaging and reaching kids. But a lot of these kids end up having to go back into environments that are really designed to strip away whatever has been invested into building them up. And so, you know, I felt like the role that I could play centered around engaging with married men.
That's
because
great.
If we could be a better example of what a real man looks like for other men to want to emulate, not saying that we have the answers or we're perfect, but I'm just saying being a better example, I think that, you know, that could end up, you know, being an inspiration to other men to really want to, if they're disconnected from their family, to engage with their family. If they're, you know, doing things that will really undermine them as individuals, that they would correct those behaviors so that, you know, we would have more men that they're just willing to be a positive example for other men to want to emulate.
That's tremendous. And Carl Lester, and I really like the fact that you're saying you're going to go look at married men, and especially before they become fathers, and really mentor and help them in that professional and then home status, to have that balance. Not, well, okay, I work all the time and never am home for my wife, I'm never home for my children, or I'm home so much I am not focusing on, you know, really putting the time and effort it takes to be a successful businessman. To have that nice balance so that families don't get broken up, so that you have then raise happy children, so that you have a better society. And especially when you talked about that number in Atlanta of 1 in 4, it's terrible. We have to figure out that. And it takes a family to make sure that those things can be changed. And that, yeah. And it's through your time and effort and leaders like yourself going out there and helping the other men through these issues and problems, for sure.
Well, you know, I hope and pray that the work that I do and how I choose to serve others within the community, I do hope that it does have a profound impact and reverberates out to positively impact other communities, where guys that really engage with us wherever, you know, it will impact communities wherever they go. And so, you know, we are seeing positive results. There are hundreds of other men through RadicalMentoring.com that choose to step up and embrace other men within their community, and they don't necessarily have to be married men. They don't have to necessarily be adults. They can be high schoolers. They can be college students. Wherever you feel like you can best engage with a group of young men who will eventually become older men, you know, the opportunity exists to leverage the Radical Mentoring Group initiative.
Well, that's fantastic. I love it. So give us that website again, Carl Lester, and also where can we find information on you and check you out as well? First the website, and then any information on you.
Well, the website is www.radicalmentoring.com. It's not my initiative. It's just something that I engaged with last year and just started mentoring a group of guys earlier this year. They are headquartered out of Atlanta, in particular the Alpharetta area. And then for me, you know, I'm on social media. You can find me on Twitter at Carlester. Typically send out, you know, one quote of inspiration each and every day. So hopefully if you choose to follow and engage me on social media, you'll be inspired by my quote for the day.
Well, you're a tremendous man who has been successful on the football field and now in the game of life in your career right now and also mentoring others. And you should be commended for that, Carlester. And I appreciate you coming on the show and best of luck. And let me know if you have any other things to promote. Reach out to me. You're welcome to come on the show anytime. So thanks again for calling.
I appreciate it, Neil. Thanks.
All right. Take care, Carlester. See ya. Okay. Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. And Pinterest, Neil Haley. And I'm so excited to welcome the program from Halt, Catch, and Fire, AMC, Eric Goins. Eric, thanks for calling, and I'm excited to talk to you today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm really, really happy to be here.
All right, can you tell a little bit about your background, then we're going to get right into the interview, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely. My background is I'm originally from Tampa, Florida, and I moved up here to Atlanta in 1989. And a short time after I got up here, I started taking improv classes at a local theater called Whole World Improv Theater here in Atlanta and fell in love with the whole idea of improv and what it made me feel as a human being and how I was developing as a person, and decided to take it a little further and just kind of make it more of a career path. And from that, I became a full-time actor not long after that, and I've been in Atlanta, Georgia ever since, doing improv and being an actor full-time.
And you know what's interesting? Once you are an actor in the theater with improv and stuff, because of Atlanta becoming a hotbed for movies and television, there's a lot more work opportunity than you think. Speaking of Atlanta, I've talked to a lot of guys now, and they're like, man, there's a ton of work in Atlanta because of film and TV here, and that's pretty amazing, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity here. It's really great. I mean, we just had a huge Pinewood Studios just set up shop here, which is a huge player in the game, and things have really taken a turn for the better here in Atlanta over the last few years, ever since we got the tax incentives in place. We're really happy about it.
Now, talking about improv, kind of explain that to me, because, again, I'm going to bring up my improvisation. I don't know if your publicist let you know this, because I've been playing around with some of her other clients about I was a former professional wrestler. So I know how to improvise in so many ways and come up with different things. But, so tell me specifically, maybe I have to come out to Atlanta and do some improv with you for sure. But tell me specifically, being an artistic director of the Whole World Improv Theater, what is improv? Kind of define it for our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually the assistant artistic director there at Whole World Improv Theater. But essentially, improv is performing without a script or a preconceived notion of what you're going to do on stage. And generally, we walk up onto stage in front of, we perform in front of 125 people on a regular basis. But I've done shows for as many as a few thousand, actually. And we take audience suggestions. They define the who, the where, and the what is what's happening between myself and a partner. And we just organically create right there on the spot without any preconceived notion as to what we were going to say or do or where the scene was going to be, was going to lead. So it's a really scary yet very rewarding experience.
So is it like Whose Line Is It Anyway? In certain ways?
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely just like that. Whose Line Is It Anyway? Is a great example of improv. Our show specifically is kind of Whose Line Is It Anyway meets Saturday Night Live. So it's kind of got that theatrical element to it. We do a short-form improv that are very slice-of-life driven. So when I perform generally, we're doing vignettes of what may have happened to someone that week or may happen to them the week after. It's a lot of fun, absolutely.
Well, when I think about this, I did a lot of improv. I mean, I don't have any theater training at all or acting, just pro wrestling. And you'll have to kind of put your hand on saying maybe you can act because you're a pro wrestler. But thinking about this, I would do this a lot with my students, my eighth graders going on trips. We would do impersonations and come up with a scenario and just go with it. So the audience chooses that. And a lot of the time the students say, be Kermit the Frog. Go ahead and be Darth Vader, and we'll have Darth Vader meet so-and-so. I think I'd enjoy it a lot. This seems a lot of fun for sure.
You know, it is an incredible craft for young people. My wife and I both actually teach youth and teen performers how to do improv. It is probably one of the most rewarding things I've done because it's got a lot of good lessons about not judging yourself, about self-empowerment, just a whole good lesson about, like, I'm okay, you're okay, and let's just celebrate our differences as opposed to, like, you know, point them out and making fun of them. We celebrate them, and I think those are really good lessons for young people, and I think they get a lot out of it. I think they can get a lot out of improv, for sure.
We're talking to Eric Goins from Halt, Catch, and Fire, the series on AMC. And I'm enjoying the conversation. Now let's go into this opportunity you have. Again, tell me a little bit about your role in season one of Halt, Catch, and Fire and the excitement of getting this opportunity, for sure.
Yeah, what a wonderful opportunity I've been given by Halt, Catch, Fire and AMC. Essentially, I play a character named Larry, and Larry works for Carnific Electric. And over the series of the first three episodes, you know, the story is all about the computer revolution in the early 80s. And,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of like the great West, the great frontier of a group of people who were trying to emulate what the big giants were doing at that time, like IBM and Apple, and knowing that even if you're in, like, the number three company, it's still a multi-billion-dollar industry. And so it's a group of people who try to do that. And just last night, my character was introduced last night on the series. And essentially, it was introduced in the course of Cardiff has to let go of a great deal of its employees to kind of take this new direction. And there's a small group of us that are actually the ones that are qualified to be the microprocessor engineers that Gord needs to create this machine. And so we're there. And so we become his right-hand men, and he calls us, you know, his guys. We're his guys, essentially. And Larry, to me, is, you know, kind of like that, he's the corporate guy who's very happy working for his company for his entire life, and he doesn't like change too much, but he's that, you know, he's that St. Bernard that drools, but the family still loves him. That's really kind of how I think about him, you know? But at the same time, he's that uncle that takes you to the state fair every year, so... that's kind of how I envision Larry.
So I'm sure just watching the season unfold, and now you're on the season, and that's probably why I finally get the opportunity to talk to you, because I've been wanting to talk to you for a couple weeks. Are you promoting it on your own and kind of getting to your people saying, come on, tune in, check this out, and tell me what you think, and how cool is this? And then probably being recognized more for sure now after this whole deal goes through with the episodes that you're on. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, everyone I've spoken to loves the show. I mean, it's funny. Most of my friends and family had plans of watching the show even before I let them know that I was in it, because I had to keep it kind of under wraps and until it got a little closer to my episode. And everyone I've spoken to loves it, and they're really enjoying it. And of course, you know, this is set in the early 80s, so it's really cool the way they've, you know, hair and makeup was a huge, huge thing on this set. And Kimberly Adams, the wardrobe, who was in charge of the wardrobe, she really hooked us all up with some great-looking duds. And I actually had a couple friends that didn't even recognize me on the episode last night, because the way they, you know, I've got the Steve Wozniak-looking hair,
right,
and,
right.
You know, the 80s-looking duds, and it's really awesome. It's great. It was a lot of fun to be a part of. extent. Yeah, I'm looking forward to all my friends and family kind of giving me feedback there. All of it's been very positive so far.
So now tell me also another big project coming up is Beacon Point Film. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Beacon Point is shot by Blue Lantern Films, and it was directed by Aaron Blue. And I shot it last summer. And essentially, it's about five people who decide to basically travel the Appalachian Trail. And they discover a secret along the way that essentially affects their journey. And it all kind of breaks loose once they decide.